GBW 1590 AM Denmark, W250 CV Green Bay,
and always streaming on the Civic Media
News,
app.
I'm Andy Field. 8 life terms and another 260 years in prison. That's the sentence handed to Savlo Saipov, the ISIS-inspired terrorist who carried out a deadly truck attack in New York City in 2017.
It's 5.5 years. I have headaches. I have disbalances. I'm doing the best that I can to help my wife, but sometimes it's a little bit difficult. It's 5.5 years. Our life changed quite a lot because being in a wheelchair without legs is not easy.
Aristide Melissus and his wife survived the attack. Montana has banned TikTok, becoming the first state in the nation to do so, citing security concerns over China. The Duke and Duchess of Sussex describe a chaotic scene in New York City where they say they were chased by paparazzi.
Buckingham Palace had no comment. While there were no injuries or arrests, city officials say they do take this very seriously because of the risk not just for Harry and Meghan, but for the many bystanders on these crowded New York streets.
ABC's Trevor Ault. This is ABC News. New data from the CDC finds that drug overdose deaths in the U.S. rose slightly last year, but the 2% increase is nothing like the 30% and 15% increases in 2020 and 2021. One actor dominating headlines at the Cannes Film Festival.
Johnny Depp's new film, Jean Dubarry, opened the Cannes Film Festival Tuesday night, getting a reported 7 minutes standing ovation. Wednesday, he faced the press.
Merci, merci beaucoup.
Asked what he would say to those who don't think he should be at the festival.
Who are they? Why do they care?
They are supporters of his ex-wife, Amber Heard, who's accused Depp of abuse, allegations he denies.
Anonymous, with apparently a lot of spare time.
He also said it's a strange time in Hollywood because no one can be their true selves.
Because they must fall in line with the person in front of them.
He says that's not the kind of life he wants to live. Jason Nathanson, ABC News, Hollywood.
The Biden administration saying it will invest more than $250 million in carbon capture and storage projects in 7 states in order to reduce pollution. Andy Field, ABC News.
Don't change the station, but do watch out for deer, would ya? You know, they're running around all willy-nilly. It is the Krebscast with me, Charlie Behrens, on Civic Media and the Civic Media app.
For Civic Media, I'm Jane Matinere. Here's what you need to know. The Wisconsin Department of Transportation released a rail plan this week calling for a new passenger connection between Milwaukee and Madison and extending the Amtrak Hiawatha route to Green Bay and the Fox Cities. The plan estimates yearly rail ridership will increase by more than 1 million in 2024 to over 3 million by 2050 if Wisconsin implements the suggested improvements and extensions. However, GOP Assembly Speaker Robin Voss said last year he would not support dedicating state funding to expand passenger rail service to Madison. Governor Evers traveling across Wisconsin this week to highlight $750 million in his proposed budget to expand internet access across the state. The money would improve or expand internet access to over 600,000 Wisconsin residents who either don't have broadband or can't afford it. I'm Jane Matinere. This is Civic Media News.
The Talk of Green Bay, 1590 AM and 97.9 FM WGBW programming is broadcast from the Bug Tussle Studios.
Bug Tussle, keeping you connected to the world around you.
This is the story of a very special woman. Just a few knew about her superpowers. In a matter of seconds, she turned herself into a great mathematician. She masqueraded as a regular person at work, but as a superhero at home. Everyone knows her as Gabriella. I still call her Mom.
Your hero needs you now, and AARP is here to help. Find the care guides you need to help, complete with tips and resources, at aarp.org/caregiving. Brought to you by AARP and the Ad Council.
If I could be you,
and you could be me, for just 1 hour.
If you could find a way
to get inside
each other's mind.
Walk a mile in my shoes.
Walk a mile in my shoes.
Walk a mile in my shoes.
We've all felt left out, and for some, that feeling lasts more than a moment. We can change that. Learn how at belongingbeginswithus.org. Brought to you by the Ad Council.
Walk a mile in my shoes.
Sometimes I just cannot believe all the storms we've gone through here.
I can only hope that we'll be able to leave this house to you one day, baby. You're our legacy.
Planning for these disasters will make sure we're safe and is the best way to protect that legacy.
Protect your legacy. Visit ready.gov/plan for the tools and tips you need to start your emergency preparedness plan today. Brought to you by FEMA and the Ad Council.
Hello? I'm a Marine.
No matter how you served.
My buddies from the Army are all gone now. I'm really alone.
No matter what you're going through.
I keep getting calls about the bills, and I'm trying to get a job, but I feel so stuck.
We are here for you. If you or a veteran in your life is experiencing thoughts of suicide, dial 988, then press 1 to reach the Veterans Crisis Line.
UPS Kids presents What to Expect When You're Expecting a Teenager. Learning the lingo.
Jelly. Jelly adjective. Jelly is a shorter, better way to say jealous. As in, Chloe, I am like so jelly of your unicorn phone case.
You don't have to speak teen to be a perfect parent. Thousands of teens in foster care will love you just the same. Visit AdoptUSKids.org. Brought to you by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, AdoptUSKids, and the Ad Council.
The Cripes Cast with me, Charlie Behrens, and I'll tell you what, it's more fun than tipping cows. And actually, you shouldn't really tip the cows, okay? They don't tip as easy as they think, and they might kick you in the... Never mind.
...the podcast and never miss a minute.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So today is the anniversary of the Brown versus Board of Education decision. 69th anniversary, it was decided in 1954, of a decision that had held for what, some 58 years before Plessy versus Ferguson, 1896. And look, you know, we're in one of these transition moments. We got a crazy right-wing court right now, could maybe undo all this stuff. And Brown versus Board of Education, one of those on the right-wing hit list. It started really the whole attack on public education and this whole push for privatization and, you know, all these new schemes. I'm here to share some thoughts on the anniversary and maybe what we learned from this. I've asked our good friend Mary Catherine Ricker to come talk with us. Mary Catherine is the executive director of the Albert Schenker Institute. Schenkerinstitute.org is their website if you want to check that out. Mary Catherine, thanks for taking time for us.
Of course. Thanks for having me, Rick. It's great to see you again.
So it is the anniversary, 69th anniversary of Brown versus Board of Education. What? What do we need to know? You're the front of the classroom. What do I need to know?
Well, I think one of the things that we do at the Schenker Institute is, you know, we elevate voices, we conduct a lot of our own research, and I think there are some really important lessons that we should pay attention to on the anniversary of Brown versus the Board of Education. I think the first lesson we should learn is that Brown versus the Board of Education was not a singular court case that just, you know, was in isolation. Before 1954, when the Supreme Court ruled on Brown v. Board, there were court cases popping up across the country. And we featured one of those voices earlier this week before the anniversary, where we actually had the dean of Keene University, Dr. Repollet, who talked about a landmark New Jersey desegregation case that was brought on by two moms in Trenton, New Jersey, Gladys Hedgepeth and Berlene Williams. And that was in 1943, so 11 years before Brown, you know, and a lot of people will know of the Mendez versus Westminster case as well, that came out of California, I believe, that was also pre-Brown v. Board of Education. So this wasn't, while the family in Topeka, Kansas was incredibly important to this landmark case and their bravery and their strength in bringing forward this suit deserves our thanks. It deserves our attention and it deserves our recognition. There are a host of families across the country in the middle part of the last century who continue to challenge this separate but equal notion until the Supreme Court finally heard them. And I think one of the lessons there is that As we are teaching history right now, it's important for our students and our whole communities to understand that people act collectively to improve their communities, to improve the lives of their children. And it's some of this really important history right now that, of course, is being questioned, whether students should learn it or not. And I stand firmly on the side of students should learn this rich history of our country.
No, we should learn our history. I mean, you know, back in 2015, Absolutely. We did a civil rights tour here on the program where we went all across the South. Any place where Black people were treated poorly, we went and found that they popped up museums and institutes and things to go, hey, look how bad we were. Come bring your tourism dollars. But we learned an awful lot on that, just as you pointed out, that all of this stuff came. There were fights of, you know, hundreds and thousands of people whose names history has forgotten or never knew, but moved us in a better direction to realize that more perfect union, that ideal of life, liberty, pursuit of happiness, and that we're all created equal in the eyes of the law. But, you know, I look at, like, on this day, since I've been focusing so much on the Supreme Court, this idea of using the court to expand those rights and that, you know, that more perfect union being front and center as opposed to what we're seeing today.
Well, I think one of the other things I'd love to point out, consider, like, when you ask what we are still seeing today, is also this history of segregation is still with us today. And this is where, again, when we learn our history, when we look for evidence of our history in our communities, we get to work together as a community to improve people's lives when we notice where these historical traumas are still impacting. And last year, the Shanker Institute did some research on the impact of historical housing segregation on contemporary school finances, and found that the legacy of all of that redlining and all of the housing segregation and all of those practices that at one point were legal and at other times were just cultural practices of white communities to separate housing, that history of housing segregation is still present. There is still evidence of it in contemporary school finances, in public school finances today. You can actually find that report on our website. But this is where, once we learn this history, once we learn about the sacrifices people made to improve our communities, to make our communities more integrated, for example, to make our schools more equitable, for example, then one, a community is going to gather together to protect that progress. And two, we're also going to look for those other areas we can continue to make progress. Yeah. And in this case, continuing to look at housing and to continue to look at school financing.
Now, I remember as a kid, I grew up in a housing project on the west side of Cleveland. And at the time, you know, the 1970s, we decided the best way to deal with segregation, especially with schools, was to put poor people on buses and drive them 2 hours to the other side of town where other poor people lived. And then we'd take those poor people and we'd move them back. And we were shuffling poor people around all over the place. And it didn't work. And I remember.
And meanwhile, other families of means didn't put in the same efforts to integrate communities that we were perhaps putting on some other communities.
No, they fled to the suburbs. They all went to the suburbs and they built the school systems that they wanted in the suburbs. But I remember one of the arguments, and this is why, you know, bringing up the housing segregation, you know, jumped into my head. I remember as a kid, the argument being, instead of moving the kids around, how about we move the resources or we redraw the school district lines? And that's something that stuck with me all these years. Why we didn't just, you know, move the bus lines that go to the school instead of, you know, shuffling poor people around all over the place. Why not shuffle the resources? That always seemed more logical to me.
Well, and let's also expand our definition of resources. So we all know there's probably not a community in the United States that doesn't need more affordable housing. And so let's make sure that we are putting affordable housing in every community, in every neighborhood. And then also let's make sure that every neighborhood has access to a place to grocery shop, that there are no food deserts. And let's find ways of making sure that every neighborhood also has access to the sort of transit options that exist in a community, that every neighborhood also has mitigation measures for environmental concerns like pollution. Expanding that definition of resources, I think, ends up creating the sort of equitable communities that is one way to create a lot more integration of everything.
Yeah, but the second you start talking about that, Mary Catherine, we're trained to believe there's a Hunger Games of education dollars. Yeah. That if you're going to do what you're talking about and creating opportunities for me as a kid growing up in the projects, that's going to take away from somebody else. And look, I'm advocating for my kids. Sorry about you, but I got to get mine. That's the world we've been trained to believe exists. How do we break that down?
That's right. It is, quite frankly, you apply some of that basic teaching mentality to it. If we have been taught, and you're right, there is this scarcity mentality that if one school is, or if one community is going to get something, that must mean another school or another community is not going to get something. As opposed to this mentality of, everyone actually deserves access to a world-class quality education, and these are the diverse ways we are going to do that, right? And so we are going to make sure that we send the sort of resources that a school needs to meet the needs of a gorgeous diversity of students, students from every corner of the neighborhood, from every corner of the world, students with special needs, students who are learning English as a new language, perhaps even their third or fourth language. We can reframe. And what that means is we can reteach people to say, actually, there is a way we can better meet the needs of whole communities so that you don't feel like you're not getting something. You actually feel like you're getting what you need.
There you go. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're here with Mary Catherine Ricker. She's the executive director of the Albert Shanker Institute. ShankerInstitute.org is the website if you want to check out the work that she does there and her group does. Now, I got to get your thought on this because, obviously it's the 69th anniversary of the Brown decision. And there is, there's some reporting and some thought behind the fact that this decision started the whole move towards destroying public education, as privatization and charters and all of these gimmicks keep popping up. Do you put any credence in that this decision is what started that slow slog towards destroying public education for all? Because I fear we're on that path. I'm curious your thoughts.
I think this decision directly challenged what already existed and was already existing in communities. I mean, remember, this decision challenged separate but equal, which was the accepted practice. This idea that as long as you had equal school buildings, for example, that you could actually segregate students and that was legal.
But they were never equal, just so we're clear.
Absolutely. No, exactly. And that, of course, is what an enlightened Supreme Court said, is that separate is inherently unequal. And so I actually think Brown v. Board was a bold step to try to correct what was already the mistakes that were already happening in our communities. And we were already teaching entire communities that somehow living separate lives, having segregated communities, including schools, neighborhoods, housing, like we talked about, that somehow we were teaching communities that somehow that was okay. And Brown v. Board interrupted that. And it caused people to rethink things. But let's be clear, that behavior was happening before the Supreme Court ruled. Brown v. Board was just a bold step to interrupt that system of segregation and oppression.
Let me play devil's advocate for a second. What if Brown isn't pursued? What if they said, no, we want to make sure that separate but equal is actually equal? Would we be better off today? Because you look at a lot of the areas that are struggling the most, a lot of our urban areas, a lot of rural areas, but high poverty areas are not equal to the suburbs, are not equal to the more affluent areas. Wouldn't arguing that, hey, we want to be equal with them. We want equal resources, and fighting that would have been a better route. Any thoughts?
I think the work of Brown v. Board of Education is unfinished. And the idea that that one Supreme Court decision was going to dramatically change what had been taught in communities for decade after decade after decade, that one Supreme Court decision was going to change that within the course of a year or two. Well, quite frankly, at the 69th anniversary, we've already shown that some of those lessons before Brown are very stubborn. They are very difficult for communities, for groups to unlearn. And so I actually think that the work of Brown is unfinished. And the work of Brown goes much deeper than desegregating schools. And I do believe there is a difference between desegregating a school and actually integrating a school. Because I think there's a lot more thought that goes into integrating a school and making sure that it is a school where all students are going to feel welcomed, where all students are going to have their needs met, and where, you know, where a community truly comes together to meet the needs of their students.
Lots of work to do. And front and foremost, sadly, is defending public education. I don't know if you've noticed, there are a lot of these crazy right-wing Moms for Liberty groups taking over school boards across the country, or trying to, funded by a billionaire who wants to destroy public education. So we've got a lot of work to do. But Mary Catherine, I appreciate the thoughts, the incredible work you do. The website, ShankerInstitute.org, if you want to take a look at that, suggest you do. Mary Catherine, thanks so much for the time.
Thanks for having me on, Rick. Take care.
Thanks so much. Again, make sure you check out the website, ShankerInstitute.org. Going to take a quick break. Right back with your thoughts. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. More working people. Have the talk.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors, the American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
The phone lines are open. Give Rick a call at 1-866-416-RICK. That's 1-866-416-7425.
We are AFGE, the American Federation of Government Employees. We represent 700,000 federal and D.C. government workers who are the vital threads of the fabric of American life. We support our nation's military. We take care of our nation's veterans. We protect our nation's borders. We respond to our nation's crises and natural disasters. We provide services to our nation's seniors. The American Federation of Government Employees. We work for America.
Welcome back to The Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
You think about how, you know, how courageous that decision was. You know, and I gotta tell the story. You know, my daughter today was telling me she got to write an essay on the To Kill a Mockingbird. And it's something I read, you know, over 40 years ago. And I kind of remember a little bit about it. But not every detail. And she's going, why is this and why is it social justice? Why is this? And I said, geez, I've forgotten. So I got the AI thing, the Chat GPT thing, and I just typed in the question, and it came out with what is an incredible essay about how, the main character, Atticus Finch, did the right thing at the right time. You know, he stood up against public pressure, and it was really a great essay, much better than I would have ever written, even if I wrote it, or even if I wrote the book, which was kind of frightening to me. But this is one of those things where, you know, the positive is I was able to pass that along. I didn't give her the essay. Still want her to write her own and read the book. But it was, I cheated. And I don't necessarily like to admit that, but I did. But, you know, it's that kind of, you think about the courage of that era to stand up. And, you know, when we were doing our civil rights tour, we met a lot of people who, you know, they were the first to integrate their schools. They were the first to break that color barrier. And the stories, and look, they're just a little bit older than I am. And the stories that they told, you know, the harassment, the intimidation, you know, all of the stuff that came because of the adults. The weird thing is the kids didn't have as much, especially the younger ones, as much of a problem. It was the parents. It's crazy. It tells us that we can do better. And the hope is that we have a court that wants to do better. That's the frustrating part in this for me. So, expanding rights, expanding that idea of a more perfect union, life, liberty, pursuit of happiness, all of that, or you know, tearing it apart. You know, like we're seeing in Florida, who evidently no more pronouns, I guess, in Florida. And bathroom use, forget it. Crazy stuff. Let's go to the phones. I got Gary in Minnesota on line one. Gary, how are we doing today?
Good to hear your voice again. So I just got a question for you. You like called about the debt ceiling, was that last week, I guess? And I was just thinking of something, you know, the Republican, their real base, the billionaires and the bosses, would they profit from that, or would they get hurt when we lose the dollar and all that? Maybe they got, like Henry Ford, he loved the Depression, so that was good for the working people. So just want to get your opinion. What do the bosses want? They get their way most of the time.
Thanks for the call, Gary. I appreciate it. I'll let you listen on the radio. Here's the thought. The wealthy in this country, they want more. A good majority of them, they want more. They want more power. They want more influence. And I know the story of Henry Ford. You know, he was so good to his workers. Nonsense. He was a business guy. He knew he was going to have to sell his product, and he needed consumers. So he paid his workers enough so that they could buy his vehicle, and they could be, you know, free advertisement. Because hey, my workers are buying it. They make enough to buy it, and it promoted this idea of paying workers enough to consume. He was a terrible person. I mean, the morality codes that you had to live by, the home inspections that they used to do on people's homes. I mean, it was terrible, but it was a dictatorship. And my fear, and this is where, you know, you look at what the Supreme Court's doing and attempting to repeal the 20th century and the kind of outweighted power that we've given to the Musks and the Bezoses and the billionaire class in this country, it's taking us backwards into these moments where a handful are going to be the ones who control the mass of our lives. And I know we love to believe that we're in control of everything. I control my own destiny. No, not really. You know, I've been having this back and forth with people about misclassification and people being independent contractors or being employees. And I said, look, you know, the reality is if the independent contractor model was supposed to be good for workers, they would have done it a long time ago. It's good for the corporations. It's good for the bosses. You're at will employees, and you're not even employees. There's no responsibility to you. And this is where moving away from that employer-employee relationship is, I think, a bad thing, because it can go south very quickly, while simultaneously tearing down every other institution in society. I mean, you know, I had this back and forth just today on the idea that, well, everyone should be their own LLC. Everyone should, you know, be their own business. And you know, if you work at Walmart, you should, you know, stock shelves, you're your own employee, and they pay you at the end of the day on a 1099. And that's the way work should be. We shouldn't have any of the other things. And you go, okay, that's, if we go that route, there's no Social Security, there's no Medicare, there's no unemployment insurance, there's no workers' compensation, there's none of those things. Unless you go through and say, everybody has to pay this individual bill. They're not taxes, they're individual bills. the whole thing collapses. And who benefits? The wildly wealthy. And this is the spot that I keep coming back to. The moneyed interests, they don't lose. So when they spend millions of dollars to influence elections, when they spend millions of dollars to get a Supreme Court justice put on the court, or any court, they understand return on investment, man. They understand this little bit of money they're putting up, gonna reap wild benefits in the future. That's what they know. I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in Two. On this day in labor history, the year was 1954. That was the day the U.S. Supreme Court handed down their decision in Brown versus Board of Education of Topeka. In the unanimous decision, the court declared that racial segregation in public education was illegal. The case was filed for Linda Brown, a student who had been denied enrollment in her local elementary school because she was black. The court's decision overturned the concept of separate but equal. This legal basis for discrimination and segregation had been established by the Supreme Court earlier in their 1896 Plessy versus Ferguson decision. The Brown decision overturned nearly six decades of legally sanctioned racism. The American Federation of Teachers filed an amicus brief, or friend of the court brief, in support of the Brown family. The union's motion stated, quote, "The American Federation of Teachers, whose 60,000 classroom teacher members represent the group which does the actual work of teaching the nation's children, is committed to a practice of complete equality between teachers and children of every race. This principle is written indelibly in its constitution and bylaws." In addition, the United Federation of Teachers of New York City also filed a brief with the court in support of Brown. Even after the court's decision, school desegregation did not come easy. Mobs of angry white Southerners showed up at schools to protest the admission of black students. In 1957, the National Guard had to protect nine black students attempting to enroll in school in Little Rock, Arkansas. The United Teachers Union led the American Federation of Teachers to expel Southern Union locals that refused to abide by the desegregation decision. The Brown decision helped to launch the civil rights movement. For more information, go to laborhistoryin2.com, like us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter at laborhistoryin2.
There's a common political refrain among Texas progressives: thank God for Mississippi. Our own state government, run by corporate lobbyists and right-wing nutballs, is a notorious hellhole for efforts to provide even a little more fairness for the poor, the working class, and the environment. So, Lone Star progressives need some straw to grasp to keep from tumbling into the ditch of total despair. Mississippi has been that straw. No matter how mingy our state officials are, Texans can count on the Magnolia State to be one digit worse. But have mercy! Texans are suddenly in danger of losing our reputational buffer, for Mississippi is close to making a momentous upgrade this election year. An unabashed working-class Democrat with a program of For the People reforms and an anti-plutocrat campaign for governor has already pulled even with a right-wing incumbent. Brandon Presley is the upstart's name, a little-d Democratic populist elected at 23 years old to be mayor of his small hometown where he still lives. He's now in his fourth term as a highly effective, widely popular member of the State Utility Commission. There, he has successfully battled the electric power giants and telecom profiteers on behalf of everyday ratepayers, workers, and the environment. Presley, who actually is an Elvis cousin, is not a pure liberal. He's pro-gun and anti-choice. But this is Mississippi, and while it's essential to strive for the pure light of liberalism, a multiracial majority of workaday Mississippians see Presley as a pure champion of basics they've long been denied, from health care to voting rights. So they're rallying for change. After all, even a dog knows the difference between being stumbled over and being kicked. This is Jim Hightower saying, the people of Mississippi know they're being kicked by the moneyed powers. And Brandon Presley is saying, let's kick back. To learn more, go to brandonpresley.com.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, I guess good news for Caitlin Collins. She took the Trump town hall in stride. You know, got smacked around a little bit. Called a nasty woman. Only her, evidently, CNN is going to reward her by giving her the 9 p.m. slots. She's going to be the new regular. Going to fill the slot that was left vacant after Chris Cuomo was shown the door. So, yeah, congratulations. Good for her. Is she going to get more than 100,000 views? I don't know. CNN is taking a beating over that Trump thing. Anyway, here to share some thoughts on the top stories of the day, our good friend, former Ohio congressman and political analyst, Bob Ney. Bob, thanks for taking time for us.
Yeah, thank you, Rick.
I got to tell you, before we get into anything, so people know, Bob is in India. On his cell phone in India, I get a better reception from Bob in India than I get from my wife calling me on my cell phone from the house.
Same with me. Blair, Ohio, or Newark, when I call you, this is better.
How is that possible? Let me start with this.
I don't know.
Because for me, this is the most important pressing issue of the moment. How is it possible in India you get a better sounding call from freaking India, which is it's a ways away. I know it's not around the corner, but I can't get a call from around the corner.
Right, exactly. Something's wrong.
Maybe
corporate America.
Well, you know, hey, maybe Biden's infrastructure plan is going to get us some broadband, going to get us some better cell. Who knows? I'm hoping, still very hopeful. But I want to get your thoughts on the George Santos thing. There's been some interesting tip-tap dancing around, but House Republicans blocked the Democrats from expelling him. Are we surprised by that?
No, I'm not, for several reasons. First of all, McCarthy has to have a vote, because if a member is expelled, member resigns, or a member dies, House administration, which I used to chair, Steny Hoyer was my ranking member, we run the offices. So if Santos, is expelled, the clerk of the House runs the office. The state prescribes the special election.
Right.
Now, here's something that shocks longtime friends of mine to say, well, they can just appoint. No.
No.
The U.S. House is the only seat in America. You can appoint a U.S. senator, a governor dies, you appoint. The U.S. House must be elected. Must be. So what happens? Let's do this scenario. Santos is expelled. New York decides when there's a special election, maybe in 90 days, blah, blah, blah. McCarthy is short one more vote. He's short. He's already short. He's short one more vote. He can't do that. So now, number one. Number two, it's a tough precedent. I know nobody's going to like to hear this, but it's a tough precedent if a member is, John Edwards. Let's take John Edwards. He was indicted and acquitted,
Right.
We can go through some other members, Senator from New Jersey was indicted and acquitted. So you really, if you start down the path of you got indicted,